Thank you. I'm Patty. I'm an alcoholic.
Patty.
I'm grateful to be sober. I'm grateful to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to thank Larry and the committee for inviting me and giving me an opportunity to participate in my recovery. I love Texas AA. You all know how to do it really well. I want to thank, I got a phone call from Kirsten during the week. And I answered the phone. She says, "This is Kirsten. I'm from Dallas." She said, "I won't be picking you up at the airport, but," and blah, 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 "meet me," and blah, 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 blah. So I said, "Okay," and I hung up the phone. And the next day I get a phone call from Brenda. And Brenda says, "This is Brenda. I'm from Dallas. I won't be picking you up at the airport, but," blah, 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 blah. And, you know, I'm one of those trust God kind of women. And so I emailed my friend Beverly. And I said, "I don't know, you know, I got this phone call from Kirsten who's not picking me up at the airport, and I got a phone call from Brenda who's not picking me up at the airport. Do you think somebody might be picking me up from the airport?" I had asked Brenda what the name of the hotel was, because I do know how to take a cab if necessary. And so I want to thank Robbie and her posse who were actually at the airport to pick me up and to bring me to the Harvey or wherever it is I am. I've had a great time so far. I hope you've had a good time. I've had a great time right up until this minute. It's been fun. What should I tell you about myself? My sponsor always tells me that I should tell you my name and tell you the truth. I've already told you my name. I'm not so sure I'm going to tell you the truth. And the reason for that is really clear to me. I mean, I don't know about anybody else in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I never knew that on August 20th, 2005, I was going to be standing here expecting to report to you what it used to be like. When I was out there, if I would have known that I was going to report what it used to be like, I would have paid a lot more attention to my life. I may have even taken some notes, I'm not sure. And certainly if I would have known about steps 4 and 5, I would have done some things differently. But I didn't know that I was going to report it to you, so I didn't pay a lot of attention. And coupled with that, I'm a blackout drinker. And I don't know about anybody else, but I love blackouts. I love blackouts. There was nothing more exciting to me than leaving work on August 2nd, returning on August 18th, and discovering I'd been there the entire time. It makes the time between paychecks so much shorter. I wish we could have blackouts sober. I love blackouts. But if you're a blackout drinker, it makes what it used to be like even sketchier. So a lot of what I report to you has been reported to me by other people. And I just have to kind of believe they were telling me the truth. I have a job, I had to get a fingerprint clearance, and I was being fingerprinted for my job, and I fingerprint really, really well. I have a lot of experience at fingerprinting. I know to roll with the prints. I don't try and resist it. I don't roll too fast. I just kind of go right along with it. And I was being printed, and I didn't want to raise any red flags, so I said very calmly to the woman doing the printing, I said, "How far back are you going to check?" And she looked me in the eye and said, "From the day you were born." And the book Alcoholics Anonymous says more will be revealed. It doesn't say how. So when the report came back, the woman called me, and she kind of had that hesitancy that non-alcoholics have sometimes when they talk to us. She had that hesitancy in her voice, and she said, "My report had come back," and I said, "Uh-huh," and she said, "You know, normally these reports are 2 or 3 pages long." I said, "Uh-huh." She said, "Yours was 57 pages. Do you want to see it?" Well, of course I did, and I went down and read that report. I know a lot more about what it used to be like, having read that report than I knew before, so... You know, this is what I think the truth is. It may or may not be. I like to tell the story. It's a fun story. I like to tell it. So it may or may not be true. I'm a real alcoholic. I was sitting last night when Beverly told me that to find her. And George, you said, just go through the lobby, buy scoops, past the bar, and to the where the meetings are being held. I said, only in Alcoholics Anonymous would they ask you to go past ice cream and alcohol to get to Alcoholics Anonymous. But I was sitting out there in that bar area last night, and I wonder sometimes when we're in a hotel like this what people who aren't with us think. But there was one table of people who clearly weren't with us. And they were there were two women and a man, and they had, one woman had a glass of red wine, the other one had a glass of white wine, and the guy had a beer. Not that I was paying that much attention, but... But I was sitting there watching them, and they're chatting, and they're talking, and they're chatting, and they're talking, and they're talking, and they're talking, and they're talking. And one of the women with the red wine finally reached over and picked up her wine. I thought, yeah. She picked up her glass of wine, got it to about here, started talking to the other woman, and put it down. That's wrong. And then they kept talking. They talked and talked. The guy got a phone call. He was talking on his phone without drinking his beer. And they're talking, talking, talking. She reached for it again. Got it right up to here and started talking to her friend and put it down. That's alcohol abuse. I finally had to leave. I couldn't stand it anymore. I didn't go sit someplace else. I'm a real alcoholic. I don't ignore my alcohol. I'm a real alcoholic. I didn't have my first drink of alcohol till I was 13 years old. I'm sorry I waited that long, but I had no idea what alcohol would do to me or for me. I don't remember ever thinking about alcohol. Now, I know this morning that I grew up in an alcoholic home, but I never knew that growing up. I never knew it was alcohol. I thought my dad was weird. I thought there was something definitely wrong with my mother, but I didn't know that it was alcohol. I grew up in an alcoholic home, but I had no idea about alcohol. I never thought about alcohol. I never thought I can't wait until I drink. I never thought I wouldn't drink. I just never thought about alcohol at all. And yet when I was 13 years old, I was on a camping trip with a group of girls. We were camped on the beach in Southern California. I remember that Friday night getting into the tent, and I had a bottle of vodka in my pillowcase. And to this day, I don't know where that bottle came from. I've always believed it was the grace of God, but I've never been able... I've never been able to confirm that. I took that bottle out, and I remember being excited about having it. I had no idea what alcohol would do to me or for me, but I remember being excited about having that bottle. And I asked if anybody wanted any, and they didn't. And the reason they gave me for not wanting it was all we had to mix with it was grape soda and root beer. And I said, well, so what? And I took off the top, and I drank half the bottle. I looked around the tent. Nothing had gotten different. Nothing had changed. So I drank the second half of the bottle. And that was to be the end of my social drinking. Never again after that day did I ever offer anybody a drink out of my bottle. And I don't know about anybody else in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I never had resentments until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I never had resentments out there, but one of my early resentments in Alcoholics Anonymous is I heard you talk about your first drink. And you talked about the drink, you described it. You talked about how it felt in your mouth. You talked about the warmth as it went down your throat. You talked about how it hit your stomach and it exploded. And it went to your fingernails and your toenails and you grew a couple inches, your pimples fell off, you dropped 20 pounds, you became Prince Charles and Lady Di, and wonderful things happened to you. And that simply wasn't the case for me. I had my first drink of alcohol and absolutely nothing happened to me for about 15 minutes. And at the end of the 15 minutes, the only thing that happened to me was I had to go to the bathroom. And it's my belief this morning that if you were to drink a quart of anything, in about 15 minutes, you'd have to go to the bathroom. So I got out of the tent, and I shuffled down to the outhouse, and I went in and went to the bathroom, and when I got done and went to get up, I realized I was absolutely and totally 100% paralyzed to the toilet seat. I could not move. I couldn't even blink. I didn't feel my heart beating, and I was overcome with a sense of fear. And, of course, the fear was that somebody else was going to have to come use that outhouse, and there I was, paralyzed to the toilet seat. Now, I don't know how I knew this at 13, but I somehow knew that the body was made up of energy, and I somehow figured that if I could gather my energy, I would be all right. always referred to it as my first formal meditation. Because I sat and I gathered my energy. And when it seemed to be all in one place, when it seemed to be centrally located, I just sort of fell off the toilet, out the door, into the sand, and started crawling back to the tent. Now, since coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, you've explained to me that my entire problem that night was my attitude. If my attitude would have been right, I could have had a fantasy I was in the Marines, I was being dive-bombed as I was trying to get back to safety, and if my attitude would have been right, it could have been a nice experience, but in my own defense, I have to tell you, my pants were still down at my ankles. I had started to get sick, I couldn't quite get through it, I couldn't get around it, and I've always contended under those circumstances it's a little difficult to have a good attitude. I did somehow manage to get back to the tent, I fell in and I passed out. And when I came to in the morning, I realized nobody was in the tent with me, and I couldn't figure out where they went until my eyes cleared enough that I realized I'd been sick all night long. I'd hit the top of the tent, the side of the tent. Like you've never been sick. I hadn't missed a square inch, and quite frankly, I didn't want to be in the tent either, so I got out of there. And that was my first drink of alcohol. And it was the most incredible, marvelous, magnificent, fabulous, spiritual, wonderful experience I'd ever had. And it must have been because I put some amount of alcohol into my body from that day until the day I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't always drink the kinds of things that you would classify as a beverage. I drank a lot of vanilla extract. I used to buy it by the six-pack. I remember the day the guy at the market called me over and he said, "Patty, I can't let you buy vanilla extract anymore." He says, "I can't believe anybody bakes as much as you do." And I got cut off from that supply. I drank a lot of mouthwash. I drank a lot of perfume. Taboo became my after-dinner drink of choice. I still love Taboo. If you're wearing it, I may follow you too closely and lap at your neck. In fact, when I share, I'm often tempted to introduce myself and say, "I'm Patty and I'm a pig." I'm the person that came to your house and ate and drank everything in your bathroom. And I don't think this is unusual. I don't think I'm living any different than anybody else. I think I drink because I want to drink. I don't know that I don't have a choice. I don't know that at 13 years old I put alcohol into an alcoholic body and from that day on I had no choice. I think I drink because I want to drink. I had an opportunity to go to college. I went to San Diego State. I graduated from there with a 3.8 grade point average. And I'm a chronic alcoholic. I'm drinking on a daily basis. I'm a blackout drinker. And yet I graduated from college with a 3.8 grade point average. And I share that with you because it almost killed me in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because when I got here, I told you I was too smart to be an alcoholic. Nobody with a 3.8 grade point average could possibly be an alcoholic. I stayed in San Diego and took classes for a master's degree. I'm one of those people, if I'm doing something well, I want to keep doing it. Apparently, I do school well, so I stayed and took classes for a master's degree. I left San Diego. My disease manifests itself in rationalization, justification, and denial. No matter what it is I do, I explain it to you why I'm doing it. And as I'm explaining it to you, I'm hearing it. And as I'm hearing it, I'm believing it. And I'm leaving San Diego because I've taken all the classes San Diego State has to offer. I don't think I'm leaving because I have one more drunk driving assault charge pending. Another resentment I got in Alcoholics Anonymous. I found out here you can get arrested for a single charge of drunk driving. I never knew that. I always got arrested for drunk driving assault. And it had something to do with how I got out of the car. And here's the deal. I mean, I'm driving down the street. The light comes on. I pull over. The officer walks up. Now, the first thing I do is slam the car door open. Now, my intent is to knock him in the private parts. Men are a little fussy about their private parts, so as the door's flying open, he jumps back. And when he jumps back, it's really a good thing because now he's far enough away that I can get him in focus. And I think, one of him, one of me. One of him, one of me, I think I can take him. One of him, one of me, I think I'll try. And I would go for him, and it'd be a good fight. I was a lot younger, but it was a good fight for a couple of minutes. But I wouldn't remember that back at the car, he had a friend. And the friend had a radio. And the friend would call some more friends. And pretty soon it'd be three or four of them, one of me, it's not fair anymore, I say uncle, and they take me away. And the next time the light comes on behind me, I pull over. The officer comes up, I slam the car door open, try and knock him into private parts, he jumps back to protect himself, he gets far enough away, then get him in focus, and I think, him, one of me. One of him, one of me, I think I can take him. One of him, one of me, I think I'll try, and I would go out the car for him. It'd be a good fight for a couple of minutes, but I wouldn't remember the friend, the radio, and the friend's friend. Pretty soon, be four or five of them, one of me, it's not fair anymore, and they say, uncle, and they take me away. And I didn't do that once or twice. I did that 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 times. And that's the, and never remembered the friend, the radio, and the friend's friend. And that's the insanity of mind disease. The insanity of mind disease is I do the same thing over and over, and I think the results are going to be different. This time it's a fair fight. This time I'm going to take him. And I didn't really have any consequences from much of that. I mean, they took my driver's license from me, but you really don't need that to drive a car. But I didn't have a lot of consequences. I mean, I'd pay an attorney $1,000, which was a lot of money. But I'd pay an attorney $1,000, and he'd write a letter, make a phone call, or whatever he'd do, and that'd kind of be the end of it. I never really heard much more about it. But one time, I had two pending at the same time. And my attorney was nervous. And if your attorney's nervous, I think you ought to worry about it. So I'm sitting in a bar worrying about the fact that my attorney's nervous. And as luck would have it, I'm sitting next to this guy that works in a mortuary. And I think alcoholics, we come up with really good plans really quickly. And I came up with a great one that night. We went over to the mortuary, we got a death certificate, we put my name on it, we wrote all of the pertinent information, we forged a doctor's signature, and we sent it to the court. Because they can't expect a lot from you if you're dead. And I called my attorney and I told him he didn't need to worry. He didn't worry, I didn't worry, nobody worried for, I don't know, a month or two. And then I got arrested for drunk driving assault. And that time the judge wanted to see me. And he never wanted to see me before. I really couldn't figure out why he wanted to see me this time, but I went. And I'll never forget him looking at me. He said, "Miss Ochoa, tell me, how is it a dead person is standing in my court?" I shrugged my shoulders, and with all sincerity, I said, "I don't know, bad luck." And that's what I thought it was. It was bad luck. It was circumstances and conditions. It was the cops. It was you or they or them. It was a lot of things that never occurred to me had anything to do with alcohol. Never occurred to me. So I'm leaving San Diego State. I was offered a job in Chico, California. I think I've taken all the classes San Diego State has to offer, and this is why I'm leaving. Doesn't occur to me I'm leaving because I have one more drunk driving assault charge pending. I load everything I own into my car. I take two cases of beer, two bottles of booze, and I head north. I got to Santa Ana, which isn't really the place you want to shoot for, but I was out of booze and I was thirsty. I'm a bar drinker. I'm a sleazy bar drinker. I'm a office drinker, a living room drinker, a car drinker, an alley drinker, a dumpster drinker. I don't specialize. I just drink. But I love sleazy bars. I love sleazy, nasty, disgusting bars. The kind with sawdust on the floor. And if anybody starts salivating, I'm sorry, but sawdust on the floor. I like them when the mirrors are cracked, so you kind of have to dip around to see yourself in there. The upholstery around the bar is ripped, where people have tried to hold on as they're going off the bar stool. Piece of broken furniture in the corner is always a nice touch. They're full of smoke. Well, they used to be full of smoke. In California, you can't smoke in a bar anymore, which makes no sense to me. I used to drink in places where guys could take a piss against the wall. They can still do that, but they can't smoke. But they used to be full of smoke, and they had that wonderful used booze urine smell. That, I mean, I still salivate when I think of that. I love that smell. I'm in Santa Ana, I'm out of booze, I pull off the freeway, I have a sense I can find that kind of bar without even looking for it. I pull into the parking lot of this place, I walked in, it was full of smoke, it had that wonderful smell, Willie Nelson was singing on the jukebox, and I knew I was home. 88 miles from where I started from. Alcohol had become my mother, my father, my God, my friend, my lover, my companion, my support. And at some point it had turned. I've always believed it was in the middle of my first drink. But at some point it had turned, it began to strip me of self-esteem, self-worth, dignity, decency, integrity, honesty, pride, all the things we have going for us as human beings. And long before I got to you, it had taken it all. Alcohol controlled every area of my life, where I would live, where I would work, the people I with and eventually the people I would run from. And I didn't know that I didn't have a choice. I thought I drank because I wanted to drink. I ended up in Santa Ana, 88 miles from where I started from. I never got any further north than that. I went into the profession of my choice. I rose very quickly to the top. And that, too, almost killed me in Alcoholics Anonymous because I got here and they told you I was too successful to be an alcoholic. I told you about the big oak desk I sat behind. I told you about the trophies and the plaques. What I didn't tell you about, I was in the newspaper business, and we often gave awards. And I know this morning it was because God gave me a gift, but we often won awards. And I didn't tell you about the times I would come out of a blackout, standing in a room much like this, holding an award, not knowing if I was giving it or receiving it. And so I would say thank you, and I would go sit down, and then they would elbow me and tell me I was presenting it to the Kiwanis Club, and I'd have to get up and start over again. And I didn't tell you about that. I just told you I was too successful to be an alcoholic. I arrived in Alcoholics Anonymous with what I pray God was my last drunk driving assault charge. By the end of my drinking, the state of California was starting to get really irritated about barreling down the freeway at 80 miles an hour, blowing something in the breathalyzer above your grade point average. And on what I pray God was my last drunk driving assault charge, I was taking the field sobriety test. I'm really good at field sobriety tests. I practice field sobriety tests. I'm one of those people, I get released from jail, I get the arrest report, I read it, I find out where I made my mistake so I can practice that part so that next time I'll get that part right. And I always knew there'd be a next time. Got a very high-profile job, and the cops were always looking for me. They knew what kind of car I drove, they knew what my car was, they knew what I was driving if I had your car, they knew what I was driving if I had a rental car. They always knew what I was driving, and they were always looking for me. So I practiced field sobriety tests a lot. And on what I pray God was my last drunk driving assault, I was doing, in fact, I mentioned to the officer I thought I was doing A-plus work. I mean, it was a good test. I by that time, I knew touch your finger to your nose means this. It doesn't mean that. I know how to walk. This morning, I could stand on one foot for 45 minutes. I'm really, really good at it. And at the end, the officer asked me to say the ABCs backwards. Well, the time before, I had responded with, well, I can't even do that sober. Well, then I had just confessed, and they took me away. So on the last one, when he asked me to say the ABCs backwards, I said, okay, and I turned around. See, you think it's funny. He wasn't even amused. Turned around, he cuffed me, he took me to Orange County Jail, and he put me in a cell with criminals. And I mean, there were real criminals in there. There were prostitutes in there. There were burglars in there. There were women who'd been arrested for beating their husbands, which I don't think should be a crime. But, and I knew I didn't belong there. I tried to organize a prison break, and I explained the plan very carefully and very slowly to the criminals. And it's an easy plan. We're going to get our coffee cups. We're going to bang them on the bars. When the marshal comes to see what's going on, I'm throwing my arm around her neck. We're getting her keys, and we're getting out of here. I heard something I was to hear in Alcoholics Anonymous. One of those criminals looked at me and she said, why don't you sit down and shut up? I said, fine, then y'all stay, but I'm getting out. I was going like a madwoman on those bars. Now, there's a couple problems with styrofoam cups. First one is they don't make a lot of noise. Second one is the bars have a tendency to eat them up. When the bars ate it up and it got to my knuckles and it got painful, I sat down and I shut up. And I was released from that, from jail on an OR, which I knew was a mistake, but I didn't think I should tell them about it. And I went to court on that charge. I was 26 years old. I was drunk in court that morning. It's the only way I went to court. It's the only way I went to work, the laundromat, the grocery store. It's the only way I did anything. I went to court drunk that morning. The state of California was really getting upset. And because of my past record, they were sentencing me to 10 years in prison. I have a son as a direct result of my alcoholism. I never wanted to be a mother. I found out that is not adequate birth control. And I didn't like him. I mean, he was 8 months old. He did nothing. He wept and he cried. That was about the extent of it. He did nothing. And I didn't particularly like him, but I was willing to use him that morning. And I told the judge that I was a single parent. I was self-supporting through my own contributions. I had this child. And he couldn't put me in jail. And he looked at me and he told me that he would put my son in a foster home because I was an unfit mother. Now, I would have admitted to being a lot of things, but I did not think I was an unfit. I had that kid with me every day, whether he wanted You're not. I put him in one of those plastic things you put kids in when you don't want to touch him, and he was to spend the first 11 months of his life on a pool table in a smoke-filled bar. And I thought because I had him with me, made me a fit mother. And I was being sentenced. In the middle of sentencing me, the expression on the judge's face changed. The tone of his voice got different. And he looked at me and he said, I know this won't work for you, but I'm going to offer you one more chance. And he offered me an alternative. And part of that alternative was meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I wish I could tell you that I took the alternative. I came here, I looked at the 12 steps, I knew there was a solution to the problems of my life. I worked them all in the first week and skyrocketed to recovery. And if Larry Johnson wasn't here, I would tell you that story, but that's not my story. In retrospect, I can tell you that I left the courtroom and I drank for 3 more months. I didn't drink a greater quantity. Physically, it had been impossible to drink a greater quantity of alcohol, but I drank with a sense of urgency and a desperation I had never known. And on October 4th, 1975, the day before I was to go back to court to tell the judge what I was doing with the alternative he gave me, on that day I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't know what ANA was. I thought it was something like the PTA or Parents Without Partners, and a lot of days it is. As far as I know, I had never heard the words Alcoholics Anonymous. I had no idea what you people were going to do to me or for me. And my first meeting was a speaker meeting, and it was about this size. And I can't tell you who talked that night, but I heard two things. I heard, we don't drink between meetings. Well, I quickly looked around, and I didn't see any of you drinking in the meeting. And I thought, if you're not drinking in the meeting and you don't drink between the meetings, when do you drink? I don't know how it affects other people, but it made me really nervous. I couldn't figure out why the judge sent me to a place where people didn't drink. The other thing I heard in that meeting was that the answers were in that book, Alcoholics Anonymous. So after the meeting, I stole the book. I mean, I don't get you buying one, but... I mean, I need to have the answers. And I can't tell you how irritated I was. I went home, not only could I not find the answers in that book, I couldn't even find the questions. And I thought, oh, dear God, I've stolen the wrong book, and I'm going to have to go back and get the right one. And I'm a thief. Now, I don't know I'm a thief. I have to stay sober a while. My sponsor tells me I'm a thief. I think it's incredibly important that you have a sponsor. I think it's absolutely essential that you have a sponsor who's not as emotionally involved in your life as you are. It annoys me sometimes, But she has a whole different perspective on my life than I do. I mean, she thinks I'm a thief. I mean, here's the deal. I'm in a bar drinking. The bar closes. I find some keys. I go out in the parking lot. I find the car that they fit, and I'm driving myself home. My sponsor in the San Diego police think this is Grand Theft Auto. I think it's alternative transportation. I just need to get home. Rationalization, justification, and denial, no matter what it is I do. I explain to you why I'm doing it as I'm telling you I'm hearing it as I'm hearing it, I'm believing it. And I'm a thief. It's humiliating for a thief to have stolen the wrong book. Wednesday, with 4 days of sobriety, I went to my second meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was a small discussion meeting. And in that meeting, I heard, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it. And I looked around the room, and I looked around the room, and I looked around the room, and I could not figure out what it was you had that was so hot that I should be willing to go any length to get it. I mean, look at the person next to you. Unless you're sleeping with him, what is it? I mean, I couldn't figure it out. And then I saw him. And I truly believe there's a him for each of us. This guy was a skinny little fellow. He was bald-headed. He wore baggy pants. Now, I don't see baggy pants in Dallas. I'm kind of going through baggy pant withdrawal. I work with teenagers in California. I work with kids who wear pants that have absolutely no relationship to their body size. They wear pants, they are so big they could put a homeless family in there with them. I haven't seen any of those since I've been here. I can't wait to get home tomorrow to look at boxer shorts, but... his weren't that baggy, but they were baggy. He had tennis shoes on with no shoelaces, but the holes were there where they should have been, and he nodded out during the meeting. Well, I quickly assessed the situation. I figure he's shooting heroin. Folks who shoot heroin nod out, and I could probably do this thing and not drink if I could shoot a little heroin. So I found out where he worked, and the next day I snuck down to his office, and I said, Dick, I have to do this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. It's out of jail, and I don't know how to do it. And he told me, go to meetings and read the book and talk to other alcoholics and not drink. So I guarantee you, you won't get drunk. And if you don't get drunk, your life will get different. And I'm grateful he told it to me that way. He didn't tell me my life would get better. He didn't tell me my family life would get better, my relationships would get better, my finances would get better, my job life would get better, my sex life would get better. He didn't tell me any of it would get better, and I'm grateful, because none of it has. So it's a little hope for the newcomer. But it's all gotten different. And as I stand here this morning, I can tell you from the top of my head to the tip of my toes, I have never had it so good. See, I don't know good from bad for me. I'm going through something I think is bad for me, and it generally turns out to be good for me. And I'm going through something I think is good for me, and it generally turns out to be bad for me. And I don't know good from bad for me. I've gone through times in my sobriety where my entire life has fallen apart. I've lost jobs, I've lost relationships, stuff has happened, life has happened, it's been incredibly, miserably painful. And I'm very dramatic, so I always refer to it as the dark night of the soul. Unless, of course, you're going through it, then I just tell you to get over yourself. But but in those times, if I don't drink and don't die and don't drink and don't die, and get beyond it, in retrospect, I've been able to see that every time I thought my life was falling apart, what was really happening is it was falling together. And it had to be exactly that way for God to move me to where he'd have me be. See, I'm the kind of person I settle for. My life is really, really good, and I'm fine with just how it is. And I dig a little rut, and I decorate. And I'm just... It's just fine right here, right now. But God has a plan for me beyond my wildest imagination. God has a big, big plan for me. And sometimes to get me out of that rut, I need a little kick in the butt. And that kick in the butt sometimes is painful. But I don't drink and don't die and don't drink and don't die and get beyond it to, in retrospect, see that it had to be exactly that way for God to move me to where he'd have me be. And I believed that old man that morning, and I don't even know why I believed him, but I believed him. My life, it seems to me, and this may or may not be true, I got five brothers and sisters who have a different perspective than I do. This may or may not be true, but it seems to me that people hurt me all my life. It seems to me that people disappointed me and they let me down. It seems to me I was hurt as a small child day after day after day. My parents told me they loved me any more of their love and I'd have died. Their love was physically, emotionally, and spiritually abusive. As a small child, I made a conscious decision that I just don't want to be hurt anymore. And as a small child, I began to build a brick wall between me and you. I began to build a brick wall to keep you out because I don't want to be hurt anymore. What I never knew about that brick wall is it made me a prisoner inside. I lived behind that wall in isolation and loneliness. And alcohol didn't allow me to come out and play. Alcohol just made it okay for me to be back there. And when you live behind a wall like that, you don't believe and you don't trust. And I hadn't believed a human being in a very long time. But I believed that old man that morning. And I don't know why, I didn't know why then, but I know why today. I believed him that morning because of the music of Alcoholics Anonymous. One alcoholic talking to another. One alcoholic talking to another goes through that brick wall. I went home, I already had the book, so I'd open it up and I'd read the line that says, most of us are unwilling to admit we are real alcoholics. I'd say amen and close the book, and that was reading the book. I'd go down to the Canyon Club in Laguna Beach where they have AA meetings. I'd have a cup of coffee. On the way out, I'd say hi, Jim, to the manager. He'd say hi, Patty. That was talking to another alcoholic. My court program said I had to go to two meetings a week. I thought that was really obsessive, but I was willing to go to any lengths to stay out of jail. And the only thing I did right is I didn't drink. And I didn't drink, and I didn't drink, and I didn't drink. And I pray God happens to everybody who's new what happened to me. I've been in pain in the last 29 years. Sometimes life is painful. I've been in pain in the last 29 years, but I have never been in the kind of pain that I was in 8.5 months away from my last drink. 8.5 months away from my last drink, the pain of not drinking and not recovering is the greatest pain that I've ever been in. And 8.5 months away from my last drink, that pain drove me to my knees. And on my knees, I took the first step of recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. I admitted I was powerless over alcohol. That when I drink alcohol, I have no choices. If I don't like the way I live today, if I don't drink, I can choose to live differently tomorrow. But when I drink alcohol, I don't have that choice. When I drink alcohol, I'm damned to live the way alcohol. I lived day after day after day after day. And my life had become unmanageable. I had no choices in my life. Alcohol controlled every area of my life, and I had no choices. And that day, I believe that I was given the gift of sobriety on October 4th, 1975, a gift I wasn't looking for, I didn't want, wouldn't have even thought of for myself. I was given the gift of sobriety, and that day I chose to recover in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the book says these are the steps we took which are suggested as a program of recovery. My experience is once I chose to recover in Alcoholics Anonymous, I am required to work the steps exactly the way they're written in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And that day I chose to recover. I wish I could tell you then that I looked at the rest of the steps, worked them all in a minute and a half, and skyrocketed to recovery. But that's not my story either. I've never worked any of the steps, so my back was against the wall. The pain was so great it was do it or die, and I had no other choice. I have to run out of every other good idea I have before I become willing to look at the next one of the 12 steps of recovery. And I want to talk about the steps for a minute because that's what happened for me. I believe what it used to be like, we all have the same story, we just acted it out a little bit differently. What happened for me is the 12 steps of recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. There is no way to get from where I was on October 4th, 1975, to where I am this morning, except through the power and the magic of the 12 steps. Step two for me, I'm a loner by nature. Brenda, my hostess, will tell you that. I told her her only responsibility was to take me to dinner on Saturday night early enough that I could take a little rest before the Saturday night speaker. She failed at that, but that was... that was her... Other than that, I don't need to be, I'm a loner. I like to be by myself. I like to just wander around alone. I like to sit by myself and watch people. My favorite place to be is on my couch. The book says we become disgustingly and dangerously antisocial. I didn't become that way, started out that way. I have developed one social skill in the last 29 years. You'll be happy to know I haven't used it yet today, so I still got it for today. But you know you're a loner if you don't like AA potlucks. That's generally the indicator. But the most difficult thing for me to do is to be with you. The most difficult thing for me to do is to be with you. But you give me the courage and strength to do the thing that I have the most difficulty with. And so for me, the power greater than myself in step two was not God. Now, I've never had, I used to say I never had a problem with God. I do have one problem with God. I believe we are all God's children, and I've always wanted to be an only child. That's the only problem I have with God. But for me, the power greater than myself in step two was not God. Because, you see, if I had come to believe that God was going to restore me to sanity, I would have sat on my couch. God would have flown by, sprinkled me with sanity, taken off to wherever it is God hangs out, and that would have been the end of it. I would have never had to do another thing. I would be on my couch, I'd still be in bed this morning, and somebody, because it's really early in California, I just want you to know how, what a sacrifice this is. So for me, the power greater than myself was the action of steps 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. You see, I've always tried to think my way into right living, and that has never worked for me. In Alcoholics Anonymous, your experience that you shared with me was that I would be able to act my way into right thinking. So I came to believe that the action of the steps would restore me to right thinking. And I'm happy to report that's happened. I'm an alcoholic. I'll always be an alcoholic. Every once in a while, I have a thought that a drink would be nice. It's a big drink, but a drink would be nice. When I have that thought, I just clap. I thank you for your participation. I just go about whatever it is that I'm doing. I don't have to take an action on the thought, and I don't have to beat myself up for having it. Because to take in the action of the steps, I've been restored to sanity. I can have a thought and not take an action on it. I hear people talking about step three all the time. They go, I'm on the third step. You know, every day I get up and turn my will and my life over to the care of God. Yeah, except for my sex and finances, because I don't want to be poor and celibate. every day I turn my will and my life over the care of God, but by about noon I take it back. And I'm pretty sure those people don't understand the step. I've had the same job now for 14 years. I drive the same way to work every day. I drive up Chapman Avenue in Orange. I'm driving up. I get to Schaefer. I got to make a decision, turn right, turn left, or go straight. To get to my job, I got to turn right and make a decision to turn right, and I go straight. intersection. So I make a U-turn. I'm coming back toward the intersection. I'm headed toward the intersection. Now I got to turn left. I make a decision to turn left. I go straight through the intersection. So I make another U-turn. I'm back to the intersection. Got to make a decision. Turn right, turn left. I go straight to get to my job. I got to turn right. I got to make a decision to turn right. And I go straight through the intersection. The decision I'm making has absolutely no impact on my car. I make another U-turn. I head back toward the intersection. I make a decision to turn left. I take the steering wheel and I do this. The decision, it says it in the book, although our decision is vital, it has no impact unless immediately followed by action. The decision I'm making in my car has no impact on my car. Here's a decision. How do you want to live? Chronic hopeless alcoholic, or do you want to have hope? Incomprehensible demoralization, hope. Despair, hope. It's not a tough decision. I think I'll go with hope. But the decision has no impact unless I follow it with action. And the first action for me was the fourth step. And I did my fourth step the way the book says to do it. I made the columns. I wrote down everybody I resented, which basically turned out to be everybody who breathed air that should have been mine. What they did to me, well, I wanted to tell you all my life what they did to me. How it affected me, it affected my security, my self-worth. Well, no wonder I drank. If all these people did all these things to you, you'd have drank too. And I was really having a good time doing this inventory thing that I had put off forever. And then in my zealousness, I accidentally turned the page of the big book. And after it shows the columns hidden in the body of the text, it says, referring to our list again, we put out of our minds the wrongs others had done, and we looked at our part. Well, it takes all the fun out of it. But I did that. I did that with my resentments, my fears, and my relationships. And for the first time, I saw who Patio really was. You see, I'd spent my whole life putting on a show. I put on a show my whole life, and I believed the show. I had no idea who Patio really was. And then I put the fourth step in the trunk of my car because I didn't want anybody to find it. And I drove around with a sense of impending doom. And of course, the fear was I'd be rear-ended on the freeway, my trunk would fly open, my fourth step would be everywhere. But rather than do a fifth step, I drove that way for a long time. And then one night I was in Los Angeles visiting someone and we were talking. And as we were talking, I realized I was doing a fifth step. And I thought, if I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it right. And I went to my car and I got my fourth step and I did my fifth step. And when I did my fifth step, that big brick wall I had built between me and you, one brick came out of that wall. One lousy brick. But every time I've shared with another alcoholic, another brick has come out of that wall. And this morning I have no brick wall between me and you. Well, I have a little styrofoam thing I throw up sometimes because sometimes I get afraid. Sometimes I have self-doubt. Sometimes I feel insecure. The difference is when I have those feelings, I have you. And you take my hand and walk with me. Whenever I try to do it by myself, I shortchange myself. Whenever one of you takes my hand and walks with me, you open new doors and add to my life. But sometimes you're not there. And so I throw that little styrofoam wall up until one of you walks up and blows it down and takes my hand and walks with me. I went home from doing my fifth step. I did step 6 and 7 by mistake. I didn't mean to recover this quickly, but I just by coincidence opened the big book to the part where it talks about step 6 and 7. And you don't have to be a journalism major to know the book Alcoholics Anonymous is very poorly written. Any newcomer will tell you that. But the part around step 6 and 7 gets kind of poetic. And I got lulled into reading it. And when I became aware of what I was reading, I was in the middle of the 7-step prayer. And when I became aware of what I was reading, I knew that I believed it. And that prayer took the longest journey anything's ever taken for me, the journey from my head to my heart. And I finished reading that prayer, and what it says in the book happened to me. I walked through the archway to freedom. I walked away from the person I've been all of my life to start to become the person God intended for me to be. And the best I've ever described myself when I came here was an animal with latent human tendencies. That's what walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because you've been willing to share with me, I've become very kind, very loving, very nurturing, very giving. Of course, now they're telling me it's codependency and I have to recover from it, but I love the person who I am. I'm tempted to write a book, Women Who Love Themselves Too Much. And I believe that's the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. We tell new people don't leave before the miracle happens, and we don't tell them what the miracle is. I believe the miracle here is we have an opportunity to walk away from the person we've been all of our life to start to become the person God intended for us to be. And I didn't come here for that. I just came here to stay out of jail. If I'd had it my way, I'd have shortchanged myself. Steps 8 and 9 for me are conventional ways of getting rid of conventional. I felt guilty because I was guilty. I did a lot of things to a lot of people for one more drink. If it came between you and a drink, I took a drink. A job and a drink, I took a drink. Anything and a drink, I took a drink. I did a lot of things to a lot of people for one more drink. We have a big controversy goes on every now and then in California. People talking about their eighth step, and they say, I put your name first on the list. I want you to know if I'd put my name first, I would have never gotten to number two. I made a lot of unhealthy choices, but everything I did for me. Everything I did for me. I may have made some hideous choices, but everything I did for me. My name didn't belong on that list. It wasn't about me, it was about you. It was about getting right with you. And I became willing to make amends, except my father, because I hate my father. My father was a violent drunk. He was a Jekyll and a Hyde drunk, and I seemed to be the target of his abuse. And I was willing to make amends except to my father. And I started making my amends. And the amends weren't about sorry. I'd said sorry all my life. Sorry, sorry, sorry. And then I'd do it again and get caught. Sorry, sorry, sorry. And then I'd do it again and get caught. The amends were about living my life differently, and I don't know how to do that. So I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and you share your experience with me. And you allow me to take your experience out into the world and live it, and it becomes my experience. And you share with me how to be a good employee and not drink. And I take your experience out into the world and I live it and it becomes my experience. You share with me how to be a good daughter and not take a drink. And I take your experience out into the world and live it and it becomes mine. Everything I am as a result of the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous who have shared their experiences with me and allowed me to take them out into the world and live them. I have gotten right with everybody in my life because the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous shared with me how you live your life. And I didn't come here for that either. I just came here to stay out of jail. I was sober a number of years. I'm going to say 5, maybe 6. I have no friends. I don't want friends. Friends are a nuisance. Friends are, I mean, they bother you. They say things to you like, well, where were you last night? Well, if I wanted you to know, I'd have told you before I went, you know. They're just way too much trouble. So I've never had any friends. I don't want any friends. Friends are bad. And I'm 5 or 6 years sober, I suppose, and I start noticing that people in Alcoholics Anonymous are doing more than coming to meetings. I sort of see this little group of people over here talking about going to coffee. And these people over here are going to the movies. And these folks seem to be friends. And I start suddenly think, well, I want to have a friend. So this is how I make friends. I sit next to you in a meeting, and the next meeting I sit next to you, and the third meeting I sit next to you, you are now my friend. I have a friend, and it's really, really cool. And then, though, my friend will do something to annoy me, like, oh, crack their gum. And now you can't be my friend anymore, because you've annoyed me. So the next meeting, I sit next to somebody else. And then the next meeting, the same person. And the third meeting, the same. Now I have another friend. I'm very excited because now I have a friend. But then that friend will do something to annoy me, like, oh, cross their legs and kick me. And now they can't be my friend either. And I do that for 2 or 3 meetings until that person goes and gets themselves a cup of coffee and doesn't bring me one. And now they, and AA is huge. You can do this for a really long time. And I'm going through, I'm thinking, the people in AA, I mean, they don't know how to be friends. I mean, what is wrong with you? And I'm talking to my sponsor one night, and I'm not talking about this particular thing. It just sort of was part of the conversation. People in AA don't know how to be friends, and tomorrow I'm going to go do this at work, and the day after that, and this weekend. And she said, wait a minute, back up to that friends thing. And I said, well, people in AA don't know how to be friends. I sort of explained it to her. And she says, Patty, she said, remember you wouldn't make amends to your father? I said, yeah. She said, Patty, hate doesn't know that it's directed at one person. Hate will spread out into every other relationship you try to have. I became willing to make amends to my father, not because I want to go to the father-daughter banquet. I became willing to make amends to my father because I want to have relationships with you. And so I amended that relationship, and I became a good daughter to my father. And I amended that relationship, and I started having friendships with the men and women in Alcoholics Anonymous. And my dearest, dearest friend, the book talks about we are people who normally would not mix. My dearest friend is somebody who she and I normally would not mix. I refer to her as the princess. She calls me the medicine woman. I think self-supporting through your own contributions is going to work. She thinks it's alimony. We go away for a weekend. I got a backpack over my shoulder. She's got 4 footlockers because she needs lots of costume changes. We are people who normally would not mix. But what we have in common is a passion for Alcoholics Anonymous. We sit in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and we're nodding our heads at the same things. We both are very, very active in Alcoholics Anonymous. We're in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. The bond that keeps friendships alive here is a passion for Alcoholics Anonymous. And my friend the Princess and I were, we did the most bizarre things. And she was my dearest, dearest friend. And about 4 years ago, she was diagnosed with breast cancer metastasized in her liver. And 6 weeks later, she died. And she had been my dearest friend for 18 years. And those last 6 weeks, I was with her every day. And the last 20 minutes of her life, although she had gone to sleep on Thursday, and on Saturday, she hadn't woke up yet. But I was sitting in her room for the last 20 minutes of her life talking to her and telling her that we were going to be okay. And thanking her for 18 years, the most incredible friendship I have ever known, and urging her to let go. I told her Bill and Bob probably needed her. her latest boyfriend, the ex-felon, had never gotten sober and had died an active alcoholic, and he probably needed a 12-step call. And when she took her last breath, her mother was in the room with her, her sponsor was in the room with her, I was in the room with her, and another friend was in the room, and she took her last breath and she left. And I didn't think I was going to survive it. I'm the kid who doesn't want to be hurt anymore. I had built a brick wall to keep you out because I don't want to be hurt. And I thought my heart ripped out of my chest when the princess took her last breath. And I didn't think I was going to be able to survive. But my feet knew exactly what to do. Half an hour later, I was in the middle of a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't think to do that, but my feet were trained. My feet have been trained so well. And my feet brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I sat with you. And the next day I sat with you, and the next day I sat with you, and I somehow moved through it without building that brick wall, because that's what I wanted to do. I just wanted to build that brick wall because I don't want to be hurt anymore. And I somehow moved through it without building the brick wall. And almost 4 years later, it's as painful for me this morning as it was then. But I don't have to build a brick wall between me and you. And it's okay for me to feel the pain, because if I hadn't had the depth of love that I had for Cindy, I would not have the depth of pain that I have this morning. And I wouldn't have given up a single day of those 18 years to not feel that pain this morning. I wouldn't give up a single day of it. And I share about my friend Cindy for 2 reasons. One, I want to keep her alive. And 2, I need her with me in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I wouldn't have had that relationship if I hadn't become willing to make amends to my father. Doesn't matter why you do something. Doesn't matter what your motive is. It doesn't matter what your intentions are. What matters is what you do. It's the action for me, not my intention or my motives. It's the action. Steps 10, 11, and 12 for me are the recovery steps. They're the steps that give me the privilege to sit in the middle of you and to continue to recover in Alcoholics Anonymous. 10 says the process is powerful. Keep using it. Keep writing about it, talking about it. Ask God to remove the defect. Make amends if necessary, and then turn your attention to somebody you can help. What is it I can do for you? How can I be of service? I hear us tell newcomers, let us love you until you can love yourself. My message is, let us love you until you can love somebody else. Alcoholics Anonymous works for me because I have your love coming from this hand, and I'm giving it out of this hand. Let us love you until you can love somebody else. Take it full circle. Step 11, I'm a simple person. My prayer in the morning is very simply, thy will be done. And I am so naive that I truly believe the rest of the day is God's business. My job, it seems, is to not drink, show up, and live life to the fullest. And the rest of it is God's business. My prayer at night is a little scarier offer to anybody who'd like to use it. My prayer at night is, dear God, please have people treat me tomorrow exactly the way I treated people today. And when I know I'm going to say that prayer tonight, it will hold me in good stead. It keeps me from announcing. I still count, but I don't announce items and the guy in front of me in the 10 item or less line at the grocery store. I haven't flipped anybody off on the freeway in a really long time. And I don't live my life so much out of virtue as I do. I know I'm going to say that prayer tonight. Please have people treat me tomorrow exactly the way I treated people today. And step 12 is the greatest gift you've ever given me, an opportunity to take a little of my past and give it to another alcoholic, to look into the eyes of another alcoholic and say, honey, you don't have to live that way anymore. Take my hand, come with me, sit in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you don't have to live that way anymore. I want to share with you that if just sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous were enough, however, my son would have never had a problem. My son was 11 months old when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I brought him with me. I didn't know what to do with him, so I brought him with me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And one of you would take him, and you'd hold him, and you'd whatever you do, and at the end of the meeting, you'd give him back to me. And the next meeting, I'd bring him, and you'd do whatever you did, and then you'd give him back to me. And my son grew up in Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything he knows, he learned from the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous. You taught him how to be kind and to be loving and to be caring and compassionate. You also taught him how to con and manipulate, which I've never been real thrilled with. But so you have to take the good with the bad. And my son's been to more meetings than most of the women I sponsor. If just sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous were enough, he would have never had a problem. But my son had a journey that he had to take. He had to take the journey of active alcoholism. And he was out there doing things that men and women should not have to do. He was going places where men and women should not have to go. And he was in Northern California, and he called me up. He'd had an accident. He needed 140 stitches in his head. He needed $100 and something for the emergency room. I told him I'd send a check. He said, oh no, they need the cash. I said, well, I don't know how to do that. He explained to me how to do it. taught me all about MoneyGram. I went to MoneyGram and I wired him the money. And a week or two later, he got hit by a car and he needed to go to the emergency room and needed some money. And I went to MoneyGram because now I know how to do it. And I don't know, a month later, 3 weeks later, he called me. Somebody had bit him on the toe or something. He needed to... So then I got a Money Saver card from MoneyGram, so that you get a break on the fee that it costs you to send the money when you do that. And then he needed something else, and then he needed something else, and I did everything wrong. I mean, I was in the ring with his disease, and I'm doing everything wrong. The thing I did right was I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I told you. I told you exactly what I was doing. And so I had people say things to me, doesn't it embarrass you to be doing that? I said, you know what, I would rather be embarrassed than be drunk. And I need to tell the truth in Alcoholics. If I can't tell the truth in Alcoholics Anonymous, where can I tell the truth? I would rather you think I'm stupid than to be drunk. And I was doing everything wrong. I had three or four different MoneyGram stores going on because I didn't want to go to the same 17-year-old clerk. So I go to this one. At this one, he was going to law school, and at this one, he had a couple of kids, and at this one, he had, I mean, I had stories going on, and I'm in the ring with his disease. Whenever I do battle with alcohol, I lose, whether I'm fighting it because I'm drinking it or I'm fighting it because you're drinking it. Whenever I do battle with alcohol, I lose, and I was getting the poop bit kicked out of me, and I took him to the Betty Ford Center at one time, and he did quit shooting heroin, which I was happy about, but he still was doing other stuff, and he was still drinking alcohol, and he moved back to Southern California. He said he was trying to get into the Salvation Army, and he called me up on October 23rd, 2002. He called me up, and he said, Mom, I need help. This is my only child. I love this boy almost as much as I love myself. You know what, and I'm going to tell any of you, I'm going to tell you this too. The biggest lie we tell as alcoholics is I'm only hurting myself. The biggest lie we tell, because I'm going to tell you what, my son's active alcoholism was one of the most painful times in my life. And I would have done anything to bring him to Alcoholics Anonymous. I used to tell him, you need to go to AA. He'd call me from San Francisco, Patrick, go to an AA meeting. I am not going to go and be Patio's son. I said, Patrick, trust me. There are people in San Francisco who don't know me. Go to an AA meeting. I am not going to be Patio's son. All right. So on October 23rd, 2002, when he called me, and he said, Mom, I need help. God will do for me what I can't do for myself. God won't do for me what I can do for myself. God won't send me money in the mail because I'm able to go to work. But God will do for me what I can't do for myself. I would have never said this to my son, but out of my mouth came these words, Patrick, I can't help you anymore. If I come get you, I'm going to kill you. I can't help you anymore, but you stay where you are. And I hung up the phone and I called a man in Alcoholics Anonymous, and thank God he understood the traditions. He wasn't one of those guys that said, tell the kid to call me. He said, where is he? Whenever the hand reaches out, I am responsible. It doesn't matter whose arm that hand is attached to. He said, where is he? And I told him where he was, and he went and picked up a newcomer, and they went and got my son out of that motel room, and they brought him to the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And on October 3rd, 2005, if he keeps doing what he's doing, he'll celebrate 3 years of sobriety. Because he's been in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And because the men and women in Alcoholics Anonymous have done with him what you did with me. They didn't tell him what to do, they've shown him what to do. They've never told him what to do, they've shown him what to do. You have never told me what to do, you have shown me what to do. One of the biggest the most important commitment in Alcoholics Anonymous is coffee. Coffee maker is the most important commitment in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they made me coffee maker of my Monday night step study, and I was very excited about being coffee maker. Now, I showed up the first night to make my coffee in one of those big coffee pots. I don't know about you, but I live alone. One of those big coffee pots and a big old can of coffee. Well, I have a college education. I can figure this out. I opened up the coffee can. I poured all the coffee into the coffee pot. I plugged it in. It went baloop. 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 I mean, it took a long time. It finally perked up, and first guy got to the meeting, he pours off a big cup of coffee, he takes a big old jolt of it, the eye, its eyeballs rolled back in his head. He didn't say anything. He left the kitchen, and the next person gets some coffee, takes her eyeballs rolled back. Pretty soon they were taking like quarter cups of coffee. Nobody said this is the worst coffee I've ever had. Nobody said who made this swill. Nobody said anything. We had the meeting, and at the end of the meeting, the secretary's given his announcements, and he said, you know, we had a steering committee meeting. I thought, you did? Huh. We've decided coffee is the most important commitment in Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, yes, it is. It is so important, as a matter of fact, we're going to give Patty an assistant coffee maker. So the next week, my assistant and I show up. Now, I don't know much, but I know how to delegate. I said, okay, I'll pour it, put in the water, you do the coffee. I put in the water into the pot. He measures out the coffee into the thing. We plug it in, bloop, 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 bloop. See, they didn't tell me how to do it. They showed me how to do it. You have always shown me how to do it. You have never told me what to do. You have shown me what you do. And everything I am because you have shown me what to do. I was going to tell you something else about my son, but I can't remember what it was now. Okay, it's time to end. That's what that means. My son was sober, I don't know, 8 or 9 months, and we live together. We don't see each other except in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we're at this Wednesday night speaker meeting that he's the taper of, and we both go to. And I was out in front of the meeting before the meeting, and this young guy comes up to me and he said, "Are you Pat O's mother?" And I went and found my son and I said, "I will not be Pat O's mother." When I was 4 days sober, an old man told me if I didn't and get drunk. That old man that I thought was shooting heroin was really sober longer than I'd been alive. And the reason that he nodded out in the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous was that he had something inside that I didn't have a clue as to what it was. He had a serenity and a peace inside. He was right with us, he was right with himself, and he was right with God, and I didn't have a clue as to what that was. As a direct result of working the steps, I can tell you this. I have the ability to nod out in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. This morning, I have the experience that Dick had that night. I have the serenity and the peace inside. I am right with you, I'm right with me, and I'm right with God. I'm a chronic malcontent. It's never been enough. It's never been the right kind. It's a direct result of working the steps. It's exactly right, and it's exactly the right kind. And I'm okay with me and you and God. And I end with this, and I always end with it. I end with it because it's been my experience, and I pray, God, it's your experience. It's a line in chapter 5 that says, "There is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now." Thank you.